I want to continue this evening. Of course, next Sunday evening, we will not have evening service since it is Easter Sunday. I almost said that other Sunday, this link to Jesus, that we don't have service if it falls on a Sunday. It starts with a C. I didn't even say it. And Sarah comes out. When I mention Christmas at an odd time of the year, she says, "Now don't you do," and here she says Christmas. Now. Christmas, she's already putting up Christmas decorations? Okay. Well, I almost said Christmas, but Christmas Eve, but it's Easter Sunday. So we won't meet next Sunday night, though we will meet a good bit on Sunday and this week. But tonight we want to talk about living like Jesus, serving like Jesus. Jesus who is and was the true servant, our true example. Ronald Sider writes, "Christian faith as servanthood means that genuine Christians embrace servanthood. A lot of folks want to be served rather than to serve." But that's not at all what Jesus said concerning himself and his followers. Ed Dobson, story told about Ed Dobson, who was pastor at Calvary Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And Ed Dobson says that oftentimes he has found Christians are often better at hating than loving. And where that came from was a few years ago, he had a church member that called him and wanted him to go see her son. She wasn't sure, but she thought her son had HIV or AIDS. And so he went to see him in the hospital, and sure enough, he had AIDS. And he talked with him for a long time about that. And then he continued to visit him in the hospital, and even after he got out of the hospital, and ministered to him, even to the point of the man's death. And preached his funeral. And when he was asked about that, he said, "Well, I don't agree with the sin, but I love the man. Because God said we are to love even the sinner." And so there was a headline in the newspaper, "Ed Dobson loves homosexuals." And he got all kinds of hate mail and everything else. And he said, "Well, it's true." He said, "I do love the person, although I preach against the sin." And he continued to talk about that. And what's really interesting is, in Grand Rapids, the gay community would listen to him rather than react with vitriol, because they said, "Well, yes, he's preaching that what we're involved in is a sin, but he still ministers to our needs, servanthood, trying to love them into the kingdom rather than be belligerent." And he said he had one church member that came to him and said, "If you don't watch out, our church is going to be overrun with homosexuals." And he said, "Well, if the church gets overrun with them, that'll be terrific. They can then take their place sitting in the pews right next to the liars, the gossips, and all those who are materialists." By the way, Ed Dobson continues to preach that homosexual activity is a sin, but that the persons are still worthy of caring for their needs, kind of like the lepers that Jesus saw too. And so this then brings us to the question, thank you, Francis. This then brings us here to the question, why is it that people who worship the servant king are so seldom known as servants? Unfortunately, for a lot within the Christian church, or at least a lot of the opinion of folks outside the church, is that the church is really not about servanthood as much as it is about ranting and raving and you're going to hell if you don't do this or that, etc. And while that may be true with dying in particular sinful conditions, at the same time, and when I've often said when someone brings up what about homosexuality, etc., I say, well, the homosexual activity is a sin. Just like heterosexual activity outside of marriage is a sin. Both of them are sins in the eyes of God. And why should we care for and meet the needs of one who is having heterosexual activity outside of marriage and not care for and try to love into the community the other? It's very difficult. And I, quite frankly, I'm not always comfortable with those things in either instance. But those kinds of activities are still sinful. The question is how we deal with the sinner. How we deal with the sinner. I had my systematic theology professor, Dr. James Tull, and I don't have the direct or the sheet here. It's in one of the other Bibles. I think one of the ones that's being held together with duct tape. But Dr. Tull talked one time about preaching, and he said, you know, when people preach on hell and they rant and rave back and forth across the stage, he said, that's totally the wrong attitude to take. If we're ever going to shed a tear, it's when we should be preaching about someone that might be going to hell. Because Christ himself would shed a tear. So why is it that people who worship the servant king so seldom known as servants? Ronald Sider contends that people get, first of all, and it's true, people get defensive when someone calls attention to their sin. I mean, if you nicely call attention to somebody's sin, a lot of times they're gonna think that you're really goading them and you're after them, because who wants to have their faults brought out by someone else? Whether it's sin or whether it's something else. Who really wants somebody to start poking fun at you and pointing a finger at your faults? Whether it's sinful or the fact that you can't chew gum and walk at the same time without falling down and getting hurt. No one. And so one of the reasons that people do that is because our defense mechanisms go up. There are folks, you start pointing out that they're involved in sinful activity, whether it's an illicit sexual relationship or whether they need to practice pushaways. Y'all know what I mean by pushaways? Push away from the table. Or any other incident like that or difficulty, people get defensive. And so immediately the thought is, oh, they're after me. Also, he contends that many secular elitists, especially these days, get very nervous and very upset anytime theologically conservative Christians start getting political influence. They start thinking that we're going to try and turn everything into a theocracy. And so folks who come from, they get very defensive. And so people who react defensively to those kinds of things, even if we nicely talk about their shortcomings or their sins, even if we relate the fact that we're sinners, but so are they get defensive. And so they immediately think that we're not servants. We hate them. And then you've got those churches out there that really go around saying they hate folks. Also, many Christians fail to combine servanthood with truth. Once again, too often we have been more ferocious in attacking sin than we are gentle in loving sinners. I know y'all have never heard this before, but you know you can catch a whole lot more flies with honey than vinegar, right? Every one of us has heard that before, or something like that. But when someone begins to attack ferociously, rather than to treat one with gentleness or compassion, immediately the defenses go up, and the reaction typically is not to defend like this, but to defend by going on the attack as well. So you got people attacking each other. And rather than gently loving, we rant and we rave and we wave the Bibles and we scream and holler and point fingers. Also, Christians often mix evangelism with Western cultural arrogance. We've got the right way to do it. Sometimes you have to go in and explain some things theologically and otherwise, but I am so happy that in missions across many of the Christian denominations now, there is less colonialism and theological arrogance and more trying to train, whether we bring folks from that particular people group or country here for training, or we go there and try to help them learn some things, spread the gospel to them, help them learn some things, and then let them do the missions where they can drink the water and not have Montezuma's revenge. It's that way we're not shoving it down their throat and coercing them, which oftentimes in history we've done. Well, I mean, we're not the only religion to do so. Every world religion has done so at some point in time or another. Even the Buddhists bombing Hindus because they wouldn't agree. We tend to sometimes say, okay, we in the Western world, our culture is so much better that we're going to tell you how it's got to be. And if you don't do it this way, you can't believe, you can't truly be a believer and go to heaven. But what we're starting to do with some, and the buzzword for the last 10 years, 8 to 10 years in many different Baptist and other Protestant circles has been indigenous missions. The people who can drink the water without having Montezuma's revenge are the ones then that go out and build the churches and talk with the people. They know the language. They know the culture. Political involvement for many evangelical Christians, especially leaders, has been a self-serving power grab instead of being a voice for the weak and or the poor. What I mean by that is there are a lot of folks, and a lot of folks in senates and houses and other places, even in local governments, that use their political clout to try and force morality. And you can't force morality. You can talk about things, but you can't force morality. And what happens there, instead of being a voice for the weak or the poor, what happens there is people say, oh, well, those Christians, they're never servants. They hate everything. If it's not like theirs, they hate everything. And so, and I'm sure there are other reasons why people oftentimes see us as less than servants. Less than servants. In fact, I have had people in the last few years that if I just happen to feel led to do something for someone who's not part of the church, to kind of look at you like, okay, what is it this person's wanting in return? The other Sunday had a young man, some of y'all saw that young man that was walking around with a baby that was almost as big as he was, a toddler. Had been to PERT, but PERT was closed. Needed some food. Needed some diapers. We didn't have diapers. But needed some food and all. And he really did. I said, yes, sir. He said, now, is there anything that I need to do for this? Anything I have to do to get this? It was like, okay, I'm going to get some food from you. And I gave him a few bags of food. I'm going to get some food for you, but there must be something that you want in return. And I did tell him it was something I wanted in return. I said, yeah, there is something. He said, okay, what? I said, at some point in time, just go to a church and pray. He went, I said, that's it. And turn around and walk back in. He was wanting to know. You know, he thought, okay, he's going to give me food, but now I got to listen to something. It's kind of like one of the churches in the area three years ago, who had trunk or treat, and before children could go through trunk or treat, they had to go sit in a fellowship hall for an evangelistic sermon, and then they were allowed to go through trunk or treat. What do I have to do? And so we need to be careful about the kinds of messages we send that way. Jesus said, help the poor, help the weak, give them the good news of God's kingdom and God's love, and show it. So there are a lot of different reasons. Anybody else have a reason or an excuse that people use for sometimes not being friendly towards we who claim to be followers of Jesus?
I think some people think it's kind of hypocritical.
Like, okay, Ed, yeah.
On the same
person, judging before you judge. That's right, Ed. They think we're hypocritical, we judge. Yeah, we don't look at our own sin, we judge. Well, we do that, don't we? Yeah. Some just don't want to get involved. Yeah, that's true.
The person has a good
deal. Yeah, that's one that I fight. That's a battle that I fight a lot because I have seen the guy standing on the side of the road for days and days and days, and late one day as he's winding down after the 5 o'clock rush hour, then he goes over, throws his stuff in the back of a fairly new van and gets up in it and drives off. Yeah. So, right. Yes, that young woman that scammed every church in Piedmont. That's right. So sometimes we don't, because we're cynical, and yet, and people then say, oh, well, they don't help. They don't care. All they want is this, that, or the other out of you. So those are, and we do find that. There's a lot out there in the late modern and in the postmodern world, early postmodern world. There are a lot of folks that feel that way about church folks. There really are. And we're to blame for some of it, but not all of it. What's the basis for genuine servanthood? Well, what's the center of Christianity? Jesus Christ, right? And what was Jesus? A servant. Timothy Shaw writes, "The heart of Christian faith, indeed, the very object of Christian faith, is a servant. This servant is at the very center of the universe and is the object of our ultimate allegiance." And then he quotes Revelation 5:6. "Then I saw a lamb looking as if it had been slain, standing in the center of the throne." Jesus is the center of the universe. He's the center of our universe, but he's the center of the universe. So the center of Christianity is a servant. And Jesus says in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, "For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve." And to serve how much? "To give his life as a ransom for many." To be the ultimate servant, even to the point of dying. Now, when he says giving his life as a ransom, he is talking, yes, about his death. But he's also talking about the way he lived his life. He didn't live in luxury. Rather, he was out there with the poor and the oppressed, even though he also preached to the high and the mighty. He spent most of his time out among those who didn't have. Those who were average, everyday folks. Those who were the hurting. And so he said he came to serve rather than to be served. He ministered to the physical needs of the hurting, but he also, and oftentimes that's what he ministered to first. The physical need and then the spiritual need. And a lot of times, we in Christian churches and folks in evangelical Christian churches especially, tend to think that you got to minister to the spirit first, the spirit first, the spirit first. When sometimes what that person needs is physical help, emotional help.
And sometimes you can't get to the spirit.
That's true. Sometimes you don't get, and sometimes you don't get anywhere near the spirit for a long time until you do that. That's right. He healed many with sicknesses and diseases, and then he taught them, and they were open to that. In fact, and they show faith in Jesus coming to him. Jesus doesn't heal people in the New Testament, in the Gospels, especially the Synoptics, Mark, Matthew, and Luke. Jesus never heals anybody to get them to believe. He always heals in response to their faith, their belief. They've already come there looking for something, and they believe he can give it to them. To them, then he heals, and then they're even more open to the Spirit being healed. Jesus was seen as a suffering servant by both the church and obviously by himself. The suffering servant found in the book of Isaiah. We just dealt with this recently. Isaiah chapter 53. In fact, we read this particularly at this time of the year. And I'm going to start even before 4 and 5. "He was despised and rejected by others, a man of sorrow and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom others hid their faces, he was despised, and we held him of no account. Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases, yet we accounted him stricken, struck down by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed." And then, as we said the other day, because we were in chapter 53 in our Isaiah study, which has gone on for a year now, in our Isaiah study, the key verse, verse 6, "All we like sheep," don't want to join me, "all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid upon him the iniquity of us all." And iniquity are not accidental sins. Iniquity is intentional sin. Jesus was a suffering servant. He came to forgive. He came to have placed upon himself our intentional sins. And to take upon himself, as the servant, our intentional sins. He claimed to have the power to forgive. He was the unique Son of God and the long-awaited Messiah. But he said that and did that as a humble servant, ministering to the needs of the marginalized. Who did he minister to? Lepers. Tax collectors. Blind beggars. The woman at the well at Samaria. The woman brought to him, caught in the act of adultery. Instead of condemnation, he offered forgiveness and a price. Don't do it again. Go and live a better life with God. And he demanded of his followers sacrificial servanthood. We'll come back again later to Mark chapter 8, verse 34. This is after Peter's confession of Jesus. And it says, he called the crowd with his disciples and said to them, if any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Sacrificial servanthood. John chapter 13. Verses 14 and 15. Jesus says, so if I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have set you an example that you also should do as I have done to you. Now, does that mean we're going to start washing feet? No, that's representative and symbolic of we should be willing to do whatever it takes for that person who is in need. And who's in need of Christ. The lowest servant in the household got to wash people's feet. Not only deal with the bunions and everything else, but all the stuff had stepped in and all the dirt as they came there. And here Jesus washed the disciples' feet. He said, I'm the lowest one in the room. And in John 20, 21, Jesus said to them, peace be with you, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. And we oftentimes think, okay, that means as the Father has sent Jesus to tell the good news, we're to go out and tell the good news. And that's part of it. But the Father sent him to do what? To minister as a servant. To wash the feet. To heal. To proclaim the good news of God. In his actions, not just in his words. To be the ultimate servant. And Jesus says, as the Father sent me to do that, I'm sending you out to do the same thing. Now, all this is a whole lot easier to talk about than it is to do. Because a lot of times I don't want to do it. Depending on who's in front of me or what's going on. But that's what we're called to do. That is part of the difficulty of the task of living a Christian life. Why and how are we to embrace this and where? First of all, we get all kinds of things. And I know I really, there's things I don't like about this Ephesians chapter 5 passage. Because it's been oftentimes used to try and put women down. But here in the home, guys, Ephesians 5, 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. In home, in family relationships, we are to love each other in a servant and after a servant fashion. It's not a matter of one being lord over another. It's a matter of comradeship. It's a matter of complementarity. And that's both C-O-M-P-L-I-M-E-N. That is, we complement with a T on the end, complement. And it's also C-O-M-P-L-E-M-E-N-T. We're to be complementary with each other. Do what? Some people say Paul and some people say no. Somebody, it was a Paulinist apostle. There are folks that argue Paul, and there are folks that argue it was a Paulinist apostle. A Paulinist apostle. someone who followed Paul and followed his teachings and wrote it after. There's some things in Ephesians that some words and some constructs that some people think are actually after the time of Paul's death. But it would have been somebody who was a close follower of him and his theology who would say, well, I'm writing this to you, and if Paul were here, this is what Paul would be saying to you. We're also called to imitate Jesus' servanthood at work, in the public square. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you should follow in his steps. We're supposed to follow Christ even in the public arena, at work, in the mall. Although sometimes these days that I want to tell those, why do you have to walk four across at a third of a mile an hour? Get out of my way, let me out of the... But we're supposed to, in public, we're still supposed to follow Christ's example. I guess that also means road rage. Would Jesus honk the horn when he went by the person that... Still working on that one. But if we're going to do it at home and we're going to do it in the public workplace, where do we have to start? In the church. Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 7. And he's talking to church people, leaders and otherwise. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness. In other words, the form of a servant. And well, we say servant, translation slave, the word is actually doulos, which is slave. Jesus was slave to us. Not just a run-of-the-mill servant. He lowered himself to the point of being our slave so that we might find redemption. And so we are to be, if we're to be Christ-like, we too are to be servants. At church first, and at home, and in the workplace. Timothy Shaw writes, to be fully human is to be Christ-like, for Jesus was fully human, even as he was fully God. So if we're going to be fully human, then indeed, we are to be Christ-like. E. Stanley Jones, the most miserable people in the world are the people who are self-centered, who don't do anything for anybody except themselves. Now, we might think they're happy, but if they're that self-centered, what's their demeanor? Deep down inside, they're worried about how they're going to make themselves happy and get all they can get. They are the sinners. They are sinners of misery with no exception. On the contrary, the happiest people are the people who deliberately take on themselves the sorrows and troubles of others. Do what? But who do you think deep down inside is more happy and content? Bill Gates or Mother Teresa? My guess is Mother Teresa, who gave and gave and gave and gave and gave of herself, even to the lepers when nobody else would. But in that she found joy and happiness inside. She didn't have to have all the trappings outside. Their hearts sing with a strange, wild joy. The path of servanthood, which leads to joy, includes self-denial. Read that a few moments ago. But self-denial is not groveling self-denial from a perspective of a lack of self-worth. If we deny ourselves because we think we're just worthless and we're just horrible and we can't do anything right, poor, pitiful me. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. I think we're going to move and eat some worms. If that's how we approach it, that's not being a humble servant after Christ. Jesus' type of servanthood recognizes our dignity and worth. Why? Because we're made imago Dei, in the image of God. And God, in and through Jesus, says we're worthy of being redeemed. being redeemed. That redemption says we're worthy of being redeemed. In Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis talks about, if we, on page 180, give up yourself, and in that you will find true worth and true happiness. Eventually saying, but look for Christ and you will find Him, and with Him everything else thrown in. But give up yourself. He doesn't say, give up yourself, one word, but yourself. Self-denial. Give up yourself as the focal point of everything in the universe and look for Christ. And when you find Him, and then you will find your worth, and in that, everything else thrown in. Unfortunately, a lot of times we have had conquest evangelism versus servant evangelism in the church. Conquest evangelism is the power of the conqueror, the sword, the gun, the bomb, whatever. We're not the only ones. Those suicide bombers and those others, they do the same thing within their religion. But we've done that too. Just some examples. Coercion and enforcement. Constantine. And Constantine had that dream and then won the battle marching under the banner of a red cross on a white background and won the battle and declared his allegiance to Christ. You know what he did next? He required every one of his soldiers to swear obedience to Christ and be baptized or else. Constantine was that first emperor who issued an edict, the Edict of Milan, that said Christianity was no longer to be persecuted. And it became officially the state religion. But Constantine used the power of the sword to force all of his soldiers to confess, to be committed to Christ, and to be baptized. The Crusades, we've mentioned before, there were Christians from Rome that killed Christians in Constantinople because they wouldn't submit to the power of Rome. American Indians, we sent missionaries to American Indians. And many of those missionaries helped to support the treaties that locked the American Indian, the Native American, into reservations or else. And many of those missionaries used the power of not only the threat from God, but the power of the cavalry and the military to enforce that many of those Native Americans would make confessions of Christ and they could no longer speak in their native tongue. They had to speak in English and they could no longer have their native name, they had to be given Christian names. Yes. That's right. Yeah, it did happen in Hawaii. Of course, what helped in Hawaii later was the importation of spam. No. But yes. Right, they did. And then forced it. Spanish missionaries did the same thing. Europeans with African slaves. There are instances written down where many European Christians told Africans about Christianity while then they took them and forced them into slavery. Yeah. Well, yes, I would put italics around that. They call themselves Christian, but they use the power of the state to enforce. In fact, interestingly enough, there was a slave ship that operated out of Charleston. Anybody know the name of that slave ship? It was called the Good Ship Jesus. The Good Ship Jesus. But it was a slave ship. So sometimes there is conquest evangelism. And not just Christians. I mean, Muslims evangelize for Islam with conquest too. But then there's servant evangelism, and that's really what we're called to. The power of the servant humbly and sacrificially ministering to the needs of others. Even those of other faiths or no faiths. We're not called just to minister to Christians. We're called to minister to even the people of other faiths or no faith. Mentioned last week, Julian, the Roman Emperor Julian trying to resurrect paganism. But he had a difficult time doing that because pagans were holding on to everything for themselves. And then he talked about he wished he could resurrect it just like the Christians and Christianity, which he had tried to stamp out, because they fed the poor of the pagans, not just their own poor, and they even buried the pagan dead when the pagans wouldn't bury their own. Ministering to those of other faith or no faith. An early 1990s survey by the George Barna Group asked, among the questions asked, what would make the church, that is a Christian church, more attractive? And the overwhelming answer, a church helping the poor and the needy. So it's a matter of a servant approach also to ethical issues. You know, relativism today, postmodern era, everything's relative. All ethical decisions are relative. Depends on where I am, who I am, what I'm doing, and how I feel at the time. It's just relative. Many late modern and early postmodern ideas are that ethical norms are relative personal preferences or cultural biases. They're not universally relevant. There are no universals. Quite frankly, a lot of our children and grandchildren, those generations are in that mindset where it's personal, leave me alone. There is nothing that is ultimate truth. I run into it with college students all the time. There is no ultimate truth. The ultimate truth is whatever I say is ultimate truth at the given moment. There's a need then for us to issue a call to return or repent from moral relativism. We use the term repent and people are going to go, but you know, come back from moral relativism. Recognize that there is something, there are universals, but that starts within the church. We have to do the same thing. We must seek to avoid harsh, legalistic, unloving attitudes which only deafen the ears of those to whom we are ministering. As Sider writes, we must plead with our broken neighbors like weeping prophets, not denounce them like angry moralists. We must gently throw our arms around all those trapped in sin, love them into the kingdom, and travel with them no matter what the cost in their journey toward wholeness in Christ. After all, isn't that what Jesus did? Traveling around healing. In other words, as one person to whom Ed Dobson was speaking and ministering said to a reporter later, said, oh, he still preaches against what I'm doing as sin. But I listen to him and think about it because I know that he loves me because he serves our needs and seeks to help me get what I need. That was someone with HIV going into AIDS. We need to have servant approaches in family, husbands, wives, and children. Servant approaches to the care of the earth. And we just keep taking, but we're supposed to take care of. Go all the way back to Genesis. We're not just to be served by the earth. We're to serve. What happens if you just let your garden go and all you do is pick, pick, pick? After a while, there's not going to be anything to pick, right? Weeds are going to take over. We're to take care of it. Now, I'm not talking here at all about nature worship or any of that kind of stuff. Certainly not talking about Wiccan. You know, Wiccan's not just witchcraft. It's tied to the earth and that kind of stuff. And by the way, not only Vanderbilt, but Brown, read an article the other day, Brown University, which was started in the 1800s by Baptists, has now added all the Wiccan holidays to all the other religion holidays in their calendar. And we also need to have servant approaches in politics. That is, looking out for the poor, the weak, for our constituents, even praying for the opposite political party. Luke chapter 22. It's really interesting about this situation in Luke 22, starting in verse 24. Jesus has been with the disciples for 3 years. They have seen him walk and talk and act as a servant. And here in chapter 22, they've just had the bread and the wine, and they've been called to recognize who Jesus is. He's told them, this is at the Last Supper. He's told them that he's going to be betrayed, and they start asking, well, who is it? Who is it? Who is it? And then starting in verse 24, here they've been in this wonderful moment. They've had this Passover meal. They've seen Jesus serve. They've heard his call to servanthood. And then what do they start doing just before they go to the Garden of Gethsemane? They start arguing about who's going to have the power. When he's gone, who's going to take over? A dispute also arose among them as to which one of them was to be regarded as the greatest. Can you imagine what Jesus must have felt at that moment? I mean, what would you feel if you'd spent all of this time doing this teaching, doing this healing, teaching them this special moment here, and you're about to go out and give your life in a horrible way, and they start arguing about who's going to take over when you're gone, or which one of them is going to sit at your right hand? How would you feel? Probably pretty frustrated at the very least. But he said to them, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those in authority over them are called their benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the one who serves. For who is greater, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. That kind of servant approach, as I said before, can't be found in the political party until first of all it's found in church. Can't be found at work until first of all it's found in church and church leaders. Can't be really found at home until first of all it's found within church. We are here to serve. And the song goes, and they'll know we are Christians by our love, and they'll know we are Christians by our love. But it's not a sentimental kind of love. It's a love that through the Spirit causes us to be servants, to serve each other, and then to serve those of no faith or even other faiths. Living like Jesus means living life as a servant, even when the persons we are serving may not want our service. There were many that didn't want Jesus' service, and among those were the ones that had him crucified. And yet that didn't stop him from serving, and that didn't stop him from saying on the cross, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. As I often say, that's a whole lot easier for me to stand up here to say than it is for me to do. But that's the challenge, is to be a true servant. True to the one who called us and true to the service to which we're called.